this week on the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine podcast.
There are three different mechanisms through which secondary hypothermia can occur: increased heat loss, decreased heat production, or disrupted thermoregulation.
One of the reasons I love magnesium is that it does so many cool things throughout the body.
And so there's actually a 1984 editorial in the American Heart Journal that's titled Magnesium, Nature's Physiologic Calcium Channel Blocker.
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by host or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by this podcast is not intended and should not construe as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions are our own and not representative of University Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome
to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast. So you have some very exciting news to share with us.
I do. I will be staying at Vanderbilt next year for my ID fellowship.
Yay! Dr. Smiley staying on.
It also should be said that Alex has a real job for next year.
A real life job.
Adult job.
Yeah. So by the time that this episode's released, we should be within just a few days of Christmas.
Which is very exciting because that also happens to be my week off.
Very nice. When we get back from the holiday break, we'll have another episode of the Q-Files to go over. But for now, we're with our chiefs again today, and we've got Chief Lee Richardson here with us to talk about some electrolytes and hypothermia. So let's get started.
He also has some exciting news to share.
That's right. Whoop,
whoop. That's right, friends. I'm very excited to announce that I also am going to be hanging out here in Nashville as one of the cardiology fellows next year.
That's awesome, man. Congrats.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, super stoked.
So I hear that you have a holiday-themed case for us. Before we actually get into it, what are you most looking forward to this Christmas?
Oh, man, there's lots to look forward to. My wife and I do have some time off together, which is exciting. Other exciting news is that we are also expecting a baby in the springtime.
Man.
So many.
That's awesome.
Big news. So we do. I know, baby Richardson. So we have another ultrasound coming up this week. I'm also going to support her as best I can when she does her glucose tolerance test at the visit. They actually shipped us the bottle of sugar water. It does not look too appetizing. Not Coca-Cola. I can guarantee that much, unfortunately.
So tell us a little bit about your first case.
All right. Sounds good. Well, this first one is from Garen. So one of our rockstar third years. That he brought in one that is a little holiday themed, given that it had to do with the patient's temperature. And so he shared a 70-year-old that presented to his primary care physician actually with an original complaint of melena and black tarry stools. So he was sent straight to the emergency room. After arrival to the ER, it seemed that that was actually fake news and that he wasn't really having any black stools. But the patient was admitted because he was found to have a temperature of 89 degrees Fahrenheit.
Did you say 89?
89. That's pretty cold.
Woo.
And so with that, Garen actually taught us a lot about how to think through secondary hypothermia, or a patient being cold due to another medical condition other than simply being left out in the cold.
Yeah, what are some causes of that, Lee? I mean, the only thing that really comes to my mind is like mild hypothermia from sepsis and then like hypothyroidism, but that's kind of where my differential runs out. Casey, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
I classically think of, being from Ohio, someone who was literally left out in the cold.
Yes. Yeah. So that's kind of how I was, too, because I did not have a great approach or framework for thinking through this. And so he really broke it down into three large buckets of how to think through what's going on. But what I loved is he first described how the body typically responds when it's cold. And so the human body has to deal with the challenge of maintaining an internal or core temperature of 36 to 38 degrees Celsius. And that's independent of climatic fluctuations, whether we're here in Nashville on a balmy 70-degree day in the middle of December or up in Ohio with Casey, where it can be colder than that. And so along this thermoregulatory continuum, humans are actually really good at dissipating heat. You could probably ask Alex about the hot South Alabama summers. We can definitely get sweaty and cool yourself down. But in general, humans aren't as good at conserving heat in the cold. What he first taught us was that when heat is conserved, you typically shunt it towards your primary central vital organs, and that occurs through peripheral vasoconstriction. So this leads to decreased perfusion of the extremities and an attenuated response to the cold.
So Lee, we're shunting our blood towards the center of our body to help maintain our vital organs. That all makes sense.
What else can we do?
And so the body tries to generate heat really in a couple of different ways. I had actually never realized that this could be broken down into both shivering and non-shivering thermogenesis, or different ways the body works to try and create heat. And now shivering thermogenesis makes sense. We've all experienced that when we're cold. And the body's using muscular contraction to generate catabolic reactions that create heat as a byproduct. Garen dove deep into this and talked about actually the different muscle groups that are involved in creating thermogenesis through shivering. And so he quoted a study where one group actually combined EMG as well as FDG PET in cooled subjects to try and figure out which muscle groups, if it was superficial or deep muscle groups, that were most responsible for shivering thermogenesis. In that study, they actually found that the deeper muscles of the trunk, for example, longus calli that's located in the neck, that they were much more active than more of the peripheral as well as superficial muscle groups. So those core ones tend to help mediate the response to help keep us warm.
I feel like this is turning into like an episode of Bill Nye the Science Guy. This is awesome.
So then Garen also talked about mechanisms of non-shivering thermogenesis as well. And so this is defined as an increase in metabolic heat production that's above basal metabolism that's not associated with muscle activity. And it occurs mainly through metabolism of brown fat, and to a lesser degree, skeletal muscle, liver, and the brain. So anatomically, it's interesting that the highest brown fat reserves are actually located in the trunk and the shoulders, which is anatomically close to where those proximal trunk muscles help generate thermogenesis through shivering. And so brown fat is a highly specialized tissue. The reason that we have the brown color is because of the abundant content of mitochondria in the cytoplasm of these cells.
Lee, I feel like we're going really deep into this brown fat stuff. Where are you going with all these mitochondria?
This is a deep dive, but it's definitely worth it because it's so cool and it makes a lot of sense. So these mitochondria that fill up the brown fat are unique in their ability to uncouple oxidative phosphorylation. So we'll remember that as the pathway that ultimately normally creates ATP and has energy generation. However, the mitochondria that are located in the brown fat cells uncouple from oxidative phosphorylation and ultimately result in heat production instead of the generation of ATP.
So coming back to the clinical side of things, now that we've gone through these pathways, can we talk a little bit about the causes of hypothermia and why these pathways are important?
Absolutely. And that's one thing that Garen did really well when he was bringing it home. He reiterated that primary hypothermia is simply cold exposure. So people that have lower core body temperatures because they've been out in the cold for too long of a period. However, he really reiterated that there are three different mechanisms through which secondary hypothermia can occur. And these three buckets are increased heat loss, decreased heat production, or disrupted thermoregulation.
Lee, all those seem to make sense, kind of just talking about the mechanisms, but I always need some examples to help me really solidify these. Can we kind of run through each bucket?
Yes, a couple of the different buckets and examples within them include under increased heat loss, problems that can lead to vasodilation when it would normally not be expected. And so things that can cause this include a number of toxins and meds, including alcohol, barbiturates, lithium, nitrates, and even general anesthesia. In addition, we can have dermal breakdown. And so this is where burns and exfoliative dermatitis leads to the skin's inability to keep in warmth. Another bucket is decreased heat production. And a lot of these fall under the endocrine as well as metabolic pathways. So in endocrine, really any thyroid abnormalities, as well as hypopituitarism, can lead to decreased heat production. In addition, there are a number of case studies where adrenal insufficiency has also led to this manifestation. Under the metabolic pathway, you can consider problems such as hypoglycemia, malnutrition, and then thiamine deficiency, which can also manifest as decreased heat production. And then finally, under disrupted thermoregulation, the main categories include neurologic, inflammatory, as well as medications. So in the neurologic category, things such as stroke, spinal cord injury, or head trauma that may disrupt the central nervous system where you control thermoregulation can lead to hypothermia. Some medications can also cause this, including beta blockers, opiates, as well as some antipsychotics. And then finally, as you alluded to earlier, Alex, things such as sepsis and pancreatitis can also manifest as hypothermia due to disrupted thermoregulation. I'm feeling a little bit cold. I guess we should wrap it up here with a summary.
Man, Lee, those dad jokes are coming in nicely.
I gotta practice, So yes, again, some of the big takeaways that I'd like you guys to take from this include the three different buckets of thinking through hypothermia when it's due to a secondary cause. And this includes increased heat loss, decreased heat production, as well as disrupted thermoregulation. And then considering the causes within each of that can help guide you to do a judicious workup when evaluating these patients on the wards.
Awesome. And for your next case, I understand we're going to be talking electrolytes. This is a very sensitive subject for Casey and I.
I think we've discussed this before.
We have.
I feel very strongly that magnesium is the best electrolyte.
Wow. Well, I think it's important when we think through electrolytes, like thinking back to when we first learned about them. So when I actually, when I mentioned high school chemistry, what is your first thought? What sorts of memories go through your head?
High school chemistry. I guess I think of just like the periodic table.
I love it. The huge periodic tables. Yeah, I was worried you're going to bring up your high school dating life, but fortunately, that's not the case. So yeah, the periodic table is incredible. There are elements that are lined up in their groups and families. They describe the function, strength, the state of matter. They have the classes of metals, gases, halogens. It's the framework for thinking through all of the elements. And so in high school, I actually did have a favorite element. It's a random one, but it's molybdenum. You guys ever heard or remember of molybdenum?
No, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. Why?
I vaguely remember.
I think it's a really underrated one. But my grandpa is actually a PhD soil scientist and is one of the smartest guys that I know. And so in high school, when I was in chemistry, he showed me his PhD thesis where he studied trace metals in the tobacco fields of Western Kentucky. And he went out and measured and found that molybdenum was an essential micronutrient for plants. And so after that, it became one of my favorite metals.
Is that a real story?
That's a real story.
That's awesome.
Blake, do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite element? No, we shouldn't ask her. She's pretty boron. All right. So all of these puns have to be for something, right? I just want to share a case with you guys that relates to magnesium that one of our wonderful future pulmonary and critical care fellows, Greta, brought to us with a case from the MICU.
I'm very excited to hear more about magnesium, even if these dad jokes keep rolling.
So Greta brought us a patient that had been transferred to the medical ICU from the labor and delivery unit postpartum. This was after a rapid response for hypoxemia and unresponsiveness.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened when the patient arrived at the MICU?
On exam, when Greta and her intern ended up evaluating the patient, she was unresponsive, bradycardic, and had a clear lung exam, but minimal respiratory effort. In addition, on their neurologic exam, the patient had no deep tendon reflexes and had 1 out of 5 strength with minimal twitching in all of her extremities. And so as the MICU team did an appropriate thing with the ABCs, establishing an airway and getting more history from the transferred team, they found out that this young woman had recently given birth via induction of labor for preeclampsia with severe features.
Before we assume that everyone here knows all the stages and treatment for preeclampsia, why don't you walk us through that?
Yes, absolutely. So the definition of preeclampsia is really describing a disorder of pregnancy that begins after 20 weeks gestation. And these are patients that develop hypertension plus proteinuria with a protein to creatinine ratio greater than 0.3, or hypertension with end organ damage with or without the presence of proteinuria. Ultimately, the etiology of this disorder is due to a vasculopathy of the placenta. There's a wide spectrum of manifestations of the disease, and some can fall under the category of PE with severe features, so preeclampsia with severe features. And this includes if a young woman presents with blood pressures greater than 160 over 110, vision changes, severe headache, platelets under 100,000, doubling of the creatinine, or the presence of pulmonary edema.
You mentioned low platelets. I know that there's another condition where we worry about the platelets in pregnancy.
And that's HELLP syndrome. And this is really a constellation of hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. And most people actually describe this as a subtype of preeclampsia with severe features now. And so management includes control of the blood pressure using agents like labetalol and nifedipine, magnesium, which is used as seizure prophylaxis, and ultimately the delivery of the baby in the placenta, which resolves the condition in almost all cases.
Lee, going back to this patient, you said she had already delivered the baby, so that should help a lot of these symptoms. What did the team do next?
That's exactly right. And so what the team did is did a little bit more history taking and digging and found out that the night prior, the patient had been initiated on a magnesium drip due to significant hypertension. And this is standard of care for the management of preeclampsia with severe features. But I think dosing is actually worth mentioning here, because oftentimes our interns in internal medicine will order 4 grams of magnesium for telealarms that are going off with tachyarrhythmias, as well as a number of other conditions. However, on the obstetrics wards, they often give an initial 2-gram bolus, followed by a continuous infusion of 1 gram per hour. If you remember back to your OB rotation, I know one thing I had to do is actually go around a lot as a med student and do reflex checks. And this was to evaluate for the presence of reflexes to ensure that there was not magnesium toxicity taking place.
One of the reasons I love magnesium is that it does so many cool things throughout the body that I feel like we normally don't think about, but I could always use a refresher on why you get loss of reflexes, etc.
I love it, Casey. And here, yes, we're going to harken back to our periodic table to understand the basic mechanism to why magnesium toxicity causes those symptoms that manifested in our patient. And so magnesium, as we know, is 2+ in its ion form. And so nerding out and thinking back to that periodic table, it's actually an alkali earth metal in the second family or the second group. And do you know what element it sits right above in the periodic table? Calcium. So because it's in the same vertical column, we can recall that one would expect these elements to have similar characteristics and properties. And so there's actually a 1984 editorial in the American Heart Journal that's titled Magnesium, Nature's Physiologic Calcium Channel Blocker. So in this article, they describe the typical physiologic role of calcium, particularly when it has to help function for cardiac repolarization, which is dependent on the efflux of calcium for establishing the resting membrane potential, as well as on the intracellular movement of calcium in and out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum that helps with muscular contraction. So if magnesium functions as a calcium channel blocker, we can see why it might manifest and make sense mechanistically why we treat a number of conditions that we do. So for example, think of asthma. In asthma, we have bronchospasm, and magnesium is administered to patients when they come into the emergency department, functioning as essentially a calcium channel blocker. And so this leads to decreased calcium influx into the bronchial smooth muscle cells because the magnesium is competing with calcium for the binding of calmodulin, which then stops actin-myosin cross-bridging, relaxes the smooth muscle, helping your patient breathe easier. You can see why giving large doses of magnesium and blocking these calcium channels could lead to poor diaphragmatic function and respiratory arrest, as this striated muscle is overwhelmed by calcium channel blockade. In addition, you have decreased deep tendon reflexes because of the signal propagation from the nerve to the neuromuscular junction, which ultimately wants to excite its target muscle group, can't be excited due to the altered calcium metabolism. And this also explains why we see some of the cardiovascular symptoms with magnesium toxicity. Patients with hypermagnesemia can experience hypotension, as well as conduction abnormalities with bradycardia and at high levels, complete heart block.
Lee, I do have a question, and it's something that we've answered on the podcast before, but I think it's important to bring up. Why don't we see magnesium toxicity more frequently when these patients are getting these drips of magnesium for so long, especially when treated for preeclampsia?
Yeah, so it's a great question, Alex. You see, magnesium typically can be cleared really effectively by the kidneys in patients with normal renal function. But that's why we do the physical exam checks in addition to lab checks to ensure that the patient isn't becoming toxic. I'll also put in a plug at this point if you're interested in learning more about magnesium and how awesome of an electrolyte it is, that there's a great podcast called The Curious Clinicians, where they actually had a recent episode that looks into why magnesium is used for the treatment of torsade de pointes.
If we suspect that someone might have magnesium toxicity, what's our next step?
There are a number of ways that you can evaluate it. Physical exam findings that we mentioned earlier, including checking for flaccid paralysis, loss of deep tendon reflexes, can demonstrate significant magnesium toxicity. One of the common things that's done is actually checking magnesium labs. However, I'll mention that testing for altered magnesium homeostasis is notoriously challenging and problematic, as the lab is not always as accurate as we hope that it is. The reason is the serum level that's measured via our lab analysis really only reflects a small part of the total body magnesium content. And so intracellular content can vary greatly despite what the measurement actually says.
How do we treat magnesium toxicity?
First, by stopping any continuous magnesium infusions that are occurring.
Good call.
Yes. And then also looking into ways to have removal. And so as I alluded to earlier, the kidneys are typically very good at helping remove magnesium. You can give IV fluids to help increase urine production. You can also give loop diuretics. And then in severe cases, actually use hemodialysis to help remove magnesium. In addition, you can use calcium chloride because this will help compete against the high levels of magnesium in the body. Do you guys enjoy all the element discussions?
I'm really trying to think of a good element joke, but I think none of them can live up to Lee's.
No, it's okay. I really enjoyed hanging out with you guys tonight, so thanks for having me on the episode. This was sodium fun.
Man, Lee, you're just in rare form today, and we appreciate that.
Like I said, practicing all my dad jokes. I got to be ready. Happy holidays, guys. Hope you guys have a good one.
Stay safe.
Stay tuned for our next episode.